Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Holds Barred Podcast. Today I'm joined on the line by Tabish. How are you doing, my friend?
Yeah, very well. Thanks very much, Vlad.
I'm really excited about this because I'm fascinated by the brain and know absolutely nothing about it. But before we start, can you let the audience know what it is you do and a bit about your background, please?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Tabish Saifi. I'm a neurologist. So I work in my capacity as a neurologist, as a doctor. So a neurologist is a specialist who sees patients with problems with the nervous system, which could include the brain, the spinal cord, the nerves, or even muscle diseases. I see those patients, I make a diagnosis, and then start treatments.
When you started out your sort of journey as a doctor, Or when you got into medicine, what made you be drawn towards the brain, I guess, or the nervous system?
Yeah. Okay. So, it's a really fascinating area of clinical medicine, and the conditions that people present with are really interesting. There are many very common diseases, but there are also some very rare conditions. It's an area where you can really sort of make a difference and help people, but also the sort of stage of investigation and finding out what conditions people have is also sort of very academically stimulating. So I had as a junior doctor, I had a job working as a neurologist in a neurology hospital, and I really loved it, really fell in love with it at that point. I think I had inklings even before that during medical school, when I spent an extra year doing some specific neuroscience work within my degree, that, you know, it was something, an area that I was very interested in. It's very cliched, but, you know, it's the most complex organ and it provides for some of the most interesting clinical medicine.
I feel like I'm going to ask some really stupid questions on this podcast, but they're just things that sort of pop into my head. How much do we know about the brain and its function? Have we kind of reached the limit of understanding what the organ is capable of and what it does?
No, not at all. I think we're really, really far away from even knowing the most sort of simple things about how the brain works. There are lots of people around the world who, you know, have an interest in the brain. That might be people like me as a neurologist who has an interest particularly in diseases affecting the brain and how to diagnose those diseases and how to treat them. But you'll have lots of other people who are much more focused on the normal function of the brain. And that might be neuroscientists who have an interest in the cells within the brain, others within certain molecules within the brain, others looking at the brain more as a whole system, like a big computer, and thinking about it from that point of view. You'll also have other doctors or clinicians looking at the brain, but other types of diseases. So psychiatrists, for example, are very interested in the brain, but look at a whole different set of conditions and diseases than I might do as a neurologist.
Have we seen and I'm not going into kind of X-Men talk here, right? But are we more, is the brain capable of doing more than it does, other than, you know, generating thoughts and enabling us to function and, you know, helping us navigate the world or being essential in the way we navigate everyday life? But is there an idea in science or in medicine that the brain, there are parts of the brain that's untapped or we don't use or is dormant for some reason?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the truth of that is. I remember growing up hearing this sort of statistic that I'm sure you have, that we use 10% of our brains. I'm not sure what the truth of that is. I think, you know, the brain is a very complex organism and it does a remarkable amount and, you know, it's continuously monitoring the environment around us and it's making decisions on how to behave and interact with the environment around us and how to interact with those around us as well. I think different areas of the brain have their own sort of you know, specialist functions, as it were. And, you know, I don't think we really understand a great deal about how each of those specialist functions work. We have some ideas within that, but I'm not sure really whether it's working at its capacity or not. You know, I don't think there's some sort of huge untapped area within the brain that we're not using, but I think often we underestimate what the brain is actually doing from minute to minute. You know, if we try and look at artificial intelligence or robotics and try and mimic some of what the human brain is capable of, it's incredibly difficult. And you know, we're very, very far away from mimicking the very sort of adaptable, flexible and generalized intelligence that the human brain can provide.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that and what your thoughts are on things like artificial intelligence.
These are things that are very outside my area of expertise. So I talk about it as a layperson.
Of course, yeah, 100%. And then that's all I'm after, really. But what do you, like, your understanding of the... So there is an idea that in the future, at some point, we will reach this moment of singularity where the artificial intelligence will be able to self-procreate or mend itself or make itself better. And that from that point, it will become beyond our control. But your understanding of the brain would mean that... Is it conceivable, do you think, that we could create a brain that's artificial and it functioned like a human one? Or is it just we don't know enough? Or what do you think as a layman?
I personally don't think that the way we're approaching artificial intelligence is necessarily going to mimic how the brain works. That sort of the brain as an organic, structure works in a very unique way. The way cells within the brain function, the way they communicate with each other, the contents of the cells, the communication within the contents of the cells, etc., function in a very different way to the sort of silicon-based nature of computers. And whilst there are some parallels and similarities, I think the two, fundamentally function very differently. So I'm not sure it would exactly replicate what the human brain does, but as I said, I have no expertise whatsoever in this area, so I'm not in a good position to comment, I don't think.
Fair enough. I only bring it up because I'm kind of fascinated by that sort of AI stuff as well. It's a scary thing. Anyway, let's move on to back to the brain. So when I move my arm, am I willing that to happen, or is my brain, what comes first? Like, do you understand what the question I'm asking is? Like, yeah. I'm making a conscious decision to move my hand. I can see I'm doing it right now, and my brain is doing that as well for me, right? What is that process? Is that, if I asked the question there?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think in very simple terms, and the way we kind of understand this to make the world easy for us, is that our brain makes a decision to make a movement, and that decision is then sent to an area of the brain right at the top of the brain called the motor cortex. And the motor cortex basically then sends a message that runs down through the brain, through the what are called motor nerves or motor neurons within the brain, that travel all the way down to the spinal cord and then communicate with other motor neurons that then send a message, an electrical message, down the arm, which then sends a message to the muscle to contract. And in a very simplistic term, that's what happens, and that's how you control movements. There are other sort of modules within the brain, if you want to call it that. For example, the very back of the brain called the cerebellum, and then deep within the brain called the basal ganglia, that seem to affect and interact with how that movement is made. But from a more philosophical point of view, I think that the question about movement and free will becomes much more complicated. And I think that's an area we don't really understand very well.
Yeah. So it's right for me to be confused by that, right?
I think so, yeah.
And when what happens physically in the brain when, say, you recall a memory? Like, I can recall any memory I like within that I know I have accessible to me, like what I did yesterday or what happened when I drove the kids to school this morning. But sometimes I'll have a memory that I'd completely forgotten that had laid dormant, and it just comes back for something, for some reason. Can you explain how that might work, or is there any ideas in the in science or medicine about how or why these memories come back to us, and what happens physically in the brain when they do, if you know?
Yeah. There are different types of memory, and there are sort of memories that we use when we're doing day-to-day things. You know, if I put my keys down and I'm typing on the computer and I'm just sort of remembering almost the last step I've done, that might be something that I would describe as working memory, whilst there may be the sort of memories that we use, the sort of memories that recall what we did yesterday at lunchtime. That might be a recent episodic memory. There are other memories that recall sort of knowledge that we couldn't pinpoint a time that we necessarily learnt that information, but it's just sort of embedded within our knowledge. For example, what's the capital city of France? Well, it's Paris. That's a sort of semantic memory. And other memories might include things like autobiographical memories, things about ourselves from the distant past. So there are lots of different memories, and they all have slightly different networks and ways that they're encoded within the brain. It is very true, and I've definitely experienced that, where you can't quite remember something and then something else seems to jog your memory. There are ways that that can happen, I suppose, and it may be that other clues that are encoded with those memories, for example, a certain smell can be encoded in the brain and be related to certain memories, and sort of can go back and help jog your memory of an event from a very long time ago. So, you know, memory is pretty complex, and it interacts with the type of memory that's formed, but also other factors within the brain, for example, smells or sights or things you've heard, etc.
And when you say encoded, because that's encoded sounds kind of superficial, doesn't it? This doesn't sound like something that happens in a organic body. But whereabouts in the brain are memories kept? And is there a physical act that's happening in the brain when a memory is made?
Yeah, so there's an area of the brain called the hippocampus, which is a part of what are called the temporal lobes. We have one on each side, and they're very important for memory formation and encoding of memories. But we've gone beyond thinking about the brain as this bit does this and this bit does this, more to a stage where we think about the brain and its functions in terms of networks, so areas that connect and communicate with other areas, providing or subserving a function. This question about encoding and how that happens. Well, there are lots of things at lots of various levels that happen when the brain tries to encode or remember something. The brain is essentially made up of billions, in fact, probably 100-odd billion nerve cells or neurons. And each of these has many branches, and those branches go off and they touch or communicate with other brain cells. And on average, that, you know, each brain cell may communicate with thousands, perhaps 10,000 other brain cells. So you've got a massive amount of intercommunication between all these brain cells. And these brain cells have electrical signals or pulses running through them, but they also send tiny chemical impulses to communicate with the neighboring cells that they're branching out to touch. So these branches can evolve and change. These branches where they communicate with another nerve cell are called synapses, where they meet the other nerve cell. And these synapses can evolve and change. The receptors for those chemicals can evolve and change. So there are lots of things at lots of different levels that can evolve and change to sort of encode or write down memories.
Okay, so if so the only thing that's purely sentient or at least aware of its own conscience is the human being. How is there a difference in the way our brain is structured that enabled us to get to that stage compared to, say, an ape or any other animal really that has a brain?
I'm not sure, Flav. I'm not sure I'm the right person to ask. I think we ventured right very, very miles away from what I'm sort of expert in.
Fair enough.
Do. I mean, fundamentally, as a neurologist, I sort of see people who have, you know, medical problems that are neurological, and I diagnose and then treat those.
Yep. All right. My apologies. I get giddy when I'm thinking about these.
These are much more interesting questions, perhaps. I agree.
No worries. Okay. So I've heard about. I listened to a podcast the other day, and they were talking about the importance of sleep. What's happening? Why is sleep so important to brain function?
Yeah. Well, sleep is really critical, and we all know the feeling where, although we might be good at doing something, whether it's, well, we were talking about memories, remembering something, or even a motor skill like playing football, for example, we all know that if we haven't slept well the night before, that we tend to perform really badly on those things that we might otherwise expect to do well with. And it's very clear that sleep deprivation leads to problems with normal functioning. And that can accumulate if we're not sleeping well. So sleep's really important. There are lots of things that happen during sleep. Most of that we don't really actually understand. There are sort of new theories about how sleep might sort of rejuvenate or refresh what we're doing. There's ideas about how dreams may or may not be important to normal function of the brain. It's certainly critical for us to function normally.
Is it true that there's a flush, the brain is flushed during the night, that there is some sort of what, like a physical act that happens where the brain is flushed? Is that I had a conversation with a therapist who told me about this, that during the night at some point the brain is washed, for want of a better expression. Does that make any sense?
Well, there's this sort of more recent idea about something called the glymphatic system, which relates to cells that support, I've already talked about brain cells or nerve cells within the brain. Mm-hmm. There are other what are called supporting cells in the brain that might be important in helping sort of clear waste that builds up within the brain, you know, whether those are waste proteins or waste products of certain metabolic reactions within the brain. And it might be that that has a relationship with sleep, and also even there are interests in that clearance system with respect to aging.
Fair enough. And in terms of your ideas about sleep or what you've read, dreaming you mentioned, what in your best estimate might be the point of us dreaming? What do you think that's for, or have you read any interesting theories about what that might be about?
So there's some ideas that if when you dream, it helps you sort of store important memories. So there are experiments that have a look at people who are trying to learn a new task, like a certain motor task. And once somebody has had a refreshing sleep and is retested on the task, they might actually perform better than one would expect.
So I've had that. I've had that exact thing where I've had something that I can't solve or I'm struggling with, and I'll sleep on it, and I'll come back to it after a certain period of time. Sleep might not have been involved, and I'm able to complete it. Is the brain subconscious working on my behalf?
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? And I think it probably does. We certainly know that certain movements or, you know, motor tasks that we undertake can actually improve over time. And actually dream, there's lots of very recent research looking at how dreams or sleep might actually help us to reinforce some of those learned motor behavior. So yeah, I think it's an incredible function of the brain, and perhaps you know, it's something that we don't really understand very well, but you know, something I've experienced as well, and many of us have experienced.
I think, like, I guess in a sense, when I first noticed it, I must have noticed it in my teens, where I was able to do this, where people were able to come back to a problem that seemed somewhat impossible, and just with, and you're not even physically thinking about that problem, and then you come back to it at a later date, or after a time, and it's, for some reason, it makes much more sense than it did before. So it's like, it's not magic, but it feels like magic.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The point, can you explain? I'm interested in things like, we've done lots of podcasts around psychedelics and DMT, and the, you know, what happens in the brain when you're under the influence of certain substances. And it led us to a conversation about the pineal gland. Now, in my really rudimentary understanding of these things, this is a gland in the center of the brain that releases a chemical when you pass away. Is that correct?
When you pass away?
Sorry, yeah, I've jumped a bit. So when you pass away, the idea is that this releases an effect in the brain, or releases a chemical that affects the brain that enables that process of dying to become easier because of the stimulation that this chemical might give you. Have you ever heard of that, or have I just...
I'm not sure. I mean, it may well be true. There's so much information about the brain. You know, I know a tiny fraction of that's geared towards diagnosing and treating people with a neurological disease. Does the pineal gland release a certain... Well, it's certainly it's a sort of a gland within the brain that releases certain chemicals. So, for example... things like melatonin, which is a sleep-related chemical, that it might be important in releasing.
And can I ask you about headaches?
Mm-hmm.
What's happening in the brain when you have a headache, and why and it can move around to certain different parts of the head, not in one go, but you know, you might get a headache at the back or it might be at the front. But what's happening in the brain to cause pain?
Okay, well, that's a really good question. So I think that, you know, headaches are something that neurologists see a lot of, and we split headaches up into two very broad groups. One is what we call secondary headaches. So that's where headache is happening in the head because of the kind of things that people worry about when they come to see me. So they, you know, they're worried that they've got cancer or a tumor in the brain, for example, or a big lump in their brain, or something like meningitis, or, you know, these sort of structural or tangible things that you might expect to cause headache. These are things that cause an increase in the pressure within the skull, because, you know, there's only certain space within the skull, and if you've got something expanding within that, that causes a pressure problem. Something affecting the blood vessels, which are pain sensitive within the brain, these can all cause secondary headaches. Or something affecting other structures around the head, for example, your eye, problems with your eye, like inflammation of the eye, might cause headaches as well, or eye pain. So these are all examples of secondary headaches. But actually, day to day, lots of people get headaches, and it's not because of these other secondary causes. It's what we call a primary cause of headache. So you'll have heard of some of the things that fit within this category, things like migraine or tension type headaches. And there are other common causes of primary headache syndrome. And in these conditions, it's actually really related to chemicals and electrical activity in the nerves and within deep parts of the brain that generate.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Great pain networks that cause pain in and around the head. The location of the pain around the head can sometimes be helpful. For example, there are secondary causes of pain where a blood vessel can get torn, for example, in the neck, and that might cause neck pain and pain on one side of the head that might indicate that's the problem. Or you might develop pain around the eye that comes and goes very frequently, and that might occur in a primary headache syndrome like cluster headache, which you might or might not have heard of. So the location of the headache can help, but it's not always enough, and often not enough to give you the diagnosis. What you really need to know is the whole story. You need to examine the patient, and sometimes we need other tests like a scan of the brain to look for those, what I mentioned, secondary causes.
Yeah, and when you're scanning the brain, this is an MRI, correct?
Yeah, so there are different ways of scanning the brain. You can use CT scans, which basically use lots of x-rays, and they look at structures in the head, and they give you an image depending on the density of the of the structures within the head. MRI shows the brain in a lot more detail. It takes a bit longer to do an MRI scan. It's a bit noisier, but it gives you much greater detail of the brain, but also some of the blood vessels and the nerves in and around the brain.
I'd imagine you deal a lot with dementia and Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
Is it a case that it seems to be much more prevalent now? And it may be that I was just unaware as a kid, but it seems to be more prevalent now. And is that just a simple case of human beings are living longer, and perhaps these things wouldn't have been picked up because we died earlier, you know, in previous times? Or is there something else that's happening? Has there been an increase in the dementia diagnosis?
Yeah, so I think that's a really good question, Flav, and I think the rate of the prevalence of dementia and, for example, Alzheimer's disease is definitely increasing. And as you say, part of that might be because of the fact that we're living longer. You know, other things that might have killed us off earlier, be it cancer or cardiovascular disease, and the treatment of those sort of conditions mean that we're living, you know, well into our 80s or even 90s and sometimes beyond that. And these, what are called neurodegenerative diseases, where essentially brain cells are dying off progressively, that's what these conditions are, tend to happen increasingly with age. So that's a big, big factor. There may be other factors that we don't really understand very well that might be at play. And also actually just the diagnosis. Sometimes, I mean, you know, decades ago, people would have cognitive problems. It may not necessarily have been diagnosed. We can now make these diagnoses with a bit more certainty clinically and using certain types of scans to do that. So I think, you know, both our ability to pick it up and also the increasing prevalence with age, I guess, are the biggest factors at play. But there may be other factors that are more difficult for us to pinpoint.
My nan passed away the year before last, and I can't remember she was very, very old, but she certainly had dementia. And what we witnessed in is the typical thing that most people know about, is that she began to disappear, her personality began to disappear, an ability to recall who we were or are began to sort of falter, and then eventually she didn't remember us at all. Do you understand what's happening in the brain to make that happen?
Yeah, so I mean, these conditions we umbrella with the term dementia or neurodegenerative disease, as I've mentioned. And what happens is we see that there is a progressive loss. We mentioned earlier that there were 100 billion odd nerve cells in the brain, or neurons in the brain. And what happens is you get gradual death of some of these cells. And there are different types of dementia. You've mentioned Alzheimer's disease. There are other types of dementia, for example, Lewy body disease or frontotemporal dementia. These are a bit less common. Alzheimer's certainly the standout most common form. With each of these, we see death of nerve cells within different parts of the brain. So, you know, that pattern is quite typical. So, for example, for Alzheimer's disease, we might see death of brain cells, particularly in the hippocampus or the memory forming areas of the brain, which is why people with Alzheimer's disease have very early memory problems or problems navigating their way around familiar environments, and that very early. While in other types of dementia, for example, frontotemporal dementia, we might see death of brain cells within the front of the brain, where you sort of are making executive decisions, and also areas of language within the brain. But the other difference is that we also see these funny proteins, these sticky proteins, being deposited in the nerve cells that seem to be dying off. But we don't know whether these sticky proteins are responsible for the death of these cells, or whether they are just consequent or, you know, subsequent to the death of these cells. So they're very interesting, seeing these different proteins, and sometimes we can differentiate or segregate these types of dementia out depending on the type of sticky protein.
When were you aware of this? When did we discover the sticky proteins?
So they've been discovered over time in different forms of dementia. And we've come to understand more about them. So, for example, in Alzheimer's disease, it's been a few decades since we've understood that a sticky protein called amyloid and also tau seem to be deposited within these brain cells. And more recently, we've discovered the presence and the sort of identity of other proteins, and for example, these frontotemporal dementias, which are other types of protein. Lewy body disease, I mentioned, there's a sticky protein that's actually very similar to what's found in Parkinson's disease, which is a slightly different condition, but it's just the distribution of those sticky proteins is different. So they occur in different areas of the brain, meaning different brain cells are dying off.
So fundamentally, that's essentially what dementia is the dying of brain cells in various ways.
Yeah, exactly. And associated with a progressive decline in cognitive function or in multiple cognitive functions. Yeah.
These are sort of experience I've had. So that's why I'm asking the questions. But my mum's husband passed away. He had vascular dementia. Mm. What's that?
So that's probably a very common cause of dementia, and we have blood vessels within the brain, just like we do for the rest of our body, and we're quite familiar perhaps with the process of furring up of blood vessels, and we're aware that when we have furring up of blood vessels in the heart, that might cause a heart attack. If we have furring up of big blood vessels within the brain, that might cause a stroke. So a stroke is where, you know, a blood vessel might get...
Yeah, that's what he passed away from eventually. Yeah.
Vascular dementia tends to be a dementia, so a progressive decline in multiple cognitive functions, because of a combination of either strokes, where big blood vessels are blocking up, causing a stroke, but in addition, usually with the furring up of very small blood vessels that doesn't present itself suddenly. That seems to be a gradual accumulation. So we might see that on a scan where we see tiny little blood vessels blocked up and maybe old strokes. And this is a condition that we describe as vascular dementia.
Do you think that we'll get to a stage where we can... Is it impossible to reverse dementia? Once the damage is done, you can't reignite the dead brain cells, reanimated.
I think that's really interesting. I often get asked this question, you know, have we got a cure yet? I think the first thing to think about with dementia is this is a progressive condition. These are progressive conditions. So you can imagine the sort of graph or the line of decline gradually heading downwards. I suppose we don't at the moment really have any very good disease modifying treatments, so things that slow that progression down in the main forms of dementia like Alzheimer's. There's one exception to that and that's a new treatment that's just been approved in the US that made the news recently, but that seems to have a very minimal and controversial effect on that progression. But essentially, if we can significantly slow that progression down, that would be the first step. The second step would actually be stopping the degenerative phase completely. So once people have had some death of nerve cells, they present to a neurologist like me, we give a treatment, and then we completely stop that progression. So the graph kind of levels off completely. The third stage would be actually rejuvenating what has been lost within the brain. So, you know, almost replacing damaged or dead function. I think that latter phase, sort of recovery or turnaround of what's happened, has to be a very, very long way away. I'm much more hopeful that the first and the second stages of slowing down the process and possibly very optimistically, stopping the process altogether might be achievable over the next few years, maybe 10 years plus. But the third stage would be, I'm sure, at minimum decades away in my mind.
I guess, though, if you're slowing it down and someone gets dementia, and typically at an older age, that might be enough. You know, it enable them to have a much better quality of life for the years that remain naturally.
Yeah, I think so. I think, for example, if you're in your 70s and you've got some mild cognitive symptoms and the culture is very much to be seen very early because we've got a treatment that can stop that process, then of course, although people may have had some subtle loss in cognitive function, if they are seen early, diagnosed early, and we've got a treatment that can then very much slow that process down or even stop it, then actually that, for practical purposes, might be enough for now. Of course, it's still not the ideal setting of turning things around, but as I said, you know, the likelihood that any of us will see that in our lifetimes, I think, is low.
Okay, fair enough. I've just got a couple more questions and I'll let you go because I don't want to keep you for too long, but this is fascinating to me. What happens, you know, when you drink a cold drink or you eat ice cream?
Yeah.
And you get what is commonly called brain freeze.
Yeah.
What is happening and why is it so painful?
Okay. So, yeah, we've certainly all had that where you can get sort of a really severe, intense pain in the head. And I think I had that the other day when I drank a very cold drink. So it seems that there are actually specific headaches that we call cold-induced or cold-stimulus headache where this seems to happen. And it seems that very cold stimulation triggers a change to certain nerves and the blood vessels within the brain. So there are blood vessels that may constrict or tighten up, and there may be nerves, for example, within the sphenopalatine ganglion that might get triggered to stimulate or to, you know, send messages to the base of our brain that relate or cause that sort of headache or brain freeze.
And is it what's the function of it? Why is it happening? Is it just to say? Is it about the? Is it a warning to say that what you're doing could damage you? Not drinking cold or drinking water, but actually being in an environment that's too cold for you. Is that what that is?
Yeah, I'm not sure what that. There's presumably some sort of evolutionary function of that, I guess. Mm. And you might be right that maybe it's a warning sign that this is something that. You know, you need to be wary of, and usually any sort of pain tends to have some, acute forms of pain often have an evolutionary benefit in trying to ward you away or keep you away from those things that might be dangerous to you. So I guess, but I don't know, but that might be the origins.
I also always just find that fascinating that the sensation of pain is crucial to keeping us alive, and we wouldn't stay alive for very long without it.
Yeah,
it's an amazing thing.
Yeah.
So when you're drinking alcohol, mm-hmm. you get, you know, your you can get blurry vision. Speech is blurred.
Slurred.
That's what I was looking for. What happened in my brain where I couldn't recall that word? What was happening there? Do you know that? Because I often have, I make my living by talking.
Yeah.
And it's very frustrating at times where I can't grab the word I need, even though I know I need it.
Yeah, well, it came to you in the end, didn't it?
you gave it to me. That's what happened. But do you know what's happening in the brain when that happens or not? Would you be guessing?
Yeah, you know, you've got a range of words that you want to try and select when you're speaking, and usually you'll have certain phrases that you'll rely upon, and when you're saying something and you're trying to pick out a word that's maybe a lower frequency word in terms of your use, sometimes it can be a bit trickier, and that there might be a very brief pause, and sometimes that can be extended if you know there may be factors that that extend that. You know, we talked about sleep deprivation. I don't know if your young daughter's been keeping you up at night, but
it was getting up early to take the boy to school. The girls at home, she's been signed off because of COVID. But it's that I guess it's that thing, is that you're not working at your optimum level because you haven't given the brain everything it needs to serve you.
A bit like your computer pausing a little bit as it's trying to process functions.
I was listening to a lecture on speech, and I've just done it there. I've put in an in a pause as my brain processes what I need to say, and now I notice I'm doing it. I can't stop. Yeah, it's really annoying. I've just done it again. So the brain uses 20% of the body's oxygen and blood. Is that correct? Does it need that much?
Yeah, it's very metabolically active, so it does use a huge amount of the body's energy reserves. It's very metabolically active, a bit like the heart is, or some of the other major organs are. And even when we're apparently not doing much, what's called the resting state of the brain, it's still using up a huge amount, a large amount of blood flow, runs through the brain. And so, you know, when that is compromised, people present with different problems that affect the brain. We've talked about vascular dementia, we've talked about strokes, and these are some of the things that can be affected when the circulation to the brain is compromised.
Okay. And finally, it's not the sexiest question to ask about the brain, but fatigue. When I feel physically tired, is that my brain telling my body that I feel tired, or what's happening, I guess, in the brain when you start feeling fatigued? Sometimes you can feel it in your head, or you can feel it physically in your body. Do you know much about what causes fatigue?
Yeah, I mean, there are different types of fatigue, and we might sort of in lay terms think about physical fatigue, where you've done a large amount of exercise and your muscles are reaching a capacity, and your ability to push beyond that is difficult because of physical fatigue. But we also differentiate that from a sort of much more mental or cognitive fatigue. Some of that can be normal. If you've been working very hard, concentrating on something, you might feel a bit tired and fatigued. Some of that could be tied in with the need for sleep. But sometimes fatigue can become a pathological symptom. So, you know, it could be a marker of a problem, a condition, or a disease. Or it could signal that there are certain factors within your lifestyle, for example, stress or overwork, that are at play.
When you started out your journey to become a neurologist, does someone who wants to operate on the brain start at the same place? Like how different are those paths? And I guess why didn't you want to go into the sort of the treatment aspect rather than the diagnosis? What led you to where you were?
So what you're talking about is neurosurgery. Now, within the realm of medicine, so doctors, you've obviously got family doctors or GPs, but within a hospital or a secondary care setting, you've got doctors that specialize in different things. They can really broadly be divided up into medical specialties and then surgical specialties. So surgical specialties, for example, neurosurgery or cardiothoracic surgery or orthopedics, are groups of doctors who are able to do an operation to fix a problem. So, for example, if you've got a broken bone, you might see an orthopedic surgeon who then does an operation to fix that bone. Or if you're a neurosurgeon and somebody's fallen and hit their head and they've got bleeding in and around the brain, that's causing damage to the brain or compromising the brain, then a neurosurgeon might go in and remove blood from the brain. However, it's fair to say there are lots of diseases and lots of conditions that are not amenable to an operation. So we've talked about dementia, Flav, and we've talked about how that might include the damage or death of brain cells gradually. You can't go in with hammer and tongs and fix something like that. It's a bit like your computer sort of having an issue. You know, there are not many computing problems where you would actually, get a screwdriver and open your laptop up or your hard drive up, because that's not going to be the way that you're going to be able to help the problem. You might use a sort of more software interface. So what I do is I diagnose neurological problems. I do also treat them, but the treatments would be for conditions that are not amenable to surgical therapy. So dementia is one example. Parkinson's is another, where part of the problem is you have insufficient chemicals like dopamine within the brain, so we can replace that. There may be other conditions like multiple sclerosis, where you develop inflammation within the brain. We can't operate and remove inflammation, but what we can do is we can calm the immune system down. We can give infusions, injections, drugs to try and help the immune system not become so overactive and stop it from attacking the brain, causing inflammation. So there are lots of treatments I as a neurologist would use that, you know, are aimed at treating diseases that you can't simply go in physically to change.
Poke around in. There's have you ever seen the film Silence of the Lambs?
Yeah, some years ago, yeah.
I think there was a follow-up called Hannibal, if I remember rightly, and there's a bit where he removes the top of a guy's skull. And he's being sedated, but he's able to function and form and not be impacted by what's happening physically to his brain. Is that just fantasy? Is it can the brain be exposed and people function?
Yeah. So neurosurgeons do operations, what they call awake surgery. So there are certain operations that might be undertaken. So, for example, in my world, as a neurologist, I have a specific specialist interest in a group of neurological disorders called movement disorders. And there are certain conditions where a neurosurgeon might want to implant an electrode into the brain to stimulate that area of the brain and improve that movement disorder. And sometimes that sort of operation can be done awake, and actually it can be quite helpful in some situations to do it awake, because the patient can then demonstrate the movements and you can see a sort of instant improvement in that movement. So there are benefits to it.
There was the lady that played the violin whilst having an operation on her brain conducted.
Yeah.
Do you know about that story?
Well, there are lots of stories like this, because for example, sometimes things need to be done to the brain, for example, removal of a tumour from the brain. And sometimes that tumour or that mass might be very close to what we call eloquent functions of the brain. So eloquent functions might be things like movement of your hand or speech, and damage to those areas would have a critical impact on your quality of life. And so sometimes there might be situations where awake surgery might be helpful or beneficial, where it can be determined exactly where within the brain the surgeon is operating and trying to stay away from really sort of important eloquent functions.
It's fascinating. Thank you very much, Dabish.
That's a real pleasure, Flav.
It was. I could go on all day on it. Honestly, I could, but it's unfair on you. So we'll leave it there. But thank you so much for giving me the time.
Thanks very much, Flav.
No. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.